Okay, welcome back. Hour number two and three. We'll intro both of them right now. With us, we have some very unique folks. We're going to do some very unique radio. If you remember, if you're listening or if you remember and subscribe and can get in the archives, you'll recall that we've done two programs with remote viewer Dick Allgaier about the JFK murder with Jim Marrs, who is without question the world's foremost researcher into that tragic horror. 52 years Jim has been at it. He knows more about the JFK murder than anyone else on the planet. He has talked to so many of the principals, people who were directly and tangentially involved with it, you couldn't even count them all. Most of them are dead. Some were murdered. There's just a lot of folks who are gone. But Jim knows. And back tonight, and the man who really made all this possible is Courtney Brown of the Farsight Institute. Courtney tasked two of the world's foremost remote viewers, Dick Allgaier and Daz Smith. Daz lives in England, to take a look at November 22nd in Dallas. Neither of them, of course, knew what they were looking at. They were just given numbers and letters or some other kind of code with the task from Courtney. But Courtney made it possible. He chose the target, and he's running the show. Courtney, are you there?
I am here, Jeff. Can you hear me?
I hear you fine, thanks. Welcome back.
Well, it's my pleasure and honor always to be on your show of all shows. That's great. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. What, just briefly, and I'll bring the rest of our crew on here, but what got you to the point where you thought about organizing this operation at the Farsight Institute and using Dick and Daz to task? I mean, that was really a masterstroke, and it's showing us how astonishing remote viewing is.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. Why now? And some of the remote viewers, like Dick has actually mentioned in one video that he did when he made some comments about it, that he had to wait a long time to get this one. And Daz has mentioned also that he similarly had to wait a long time and was glad to see it come around. Well, this was a big target. This was a huge target. It was something that I knew we had to do when we were ready to do it. So we started doing these large collaborative projects way back in 2008. And we had lots of viewers doing different things. And we did the Multiple Universe Project, the Climate Project. We did a project on the origin of the asteroid belt. We've done a whole bunch of stuff, all of which were sort of science-oriented.
Uh-huh.
And then a couple of years ago, I said, okay, we've really paid our dues in terms of science-oriented projects.
Right.
Now we have to show people why it's important. What's the there? So we have to start answering some of the mysteries that exist. So we started by doing mysteries on underwater anomalies at the Atlantis Project. We then went into the Great Pyramid of Giza, how that was actually built.
Uh-huh.
And then I said, you know, why don't we go after some of the huge current ones, such as the 9/11 events? So I said, okay, we tried that. Now, after the 9/11 events, the viewers were pretty much okay with the idea that they were going to be getting surprising, but expected types of targets, Earth-based targets, mystery things. And so I decided at that point I had sort of promised them indirectly, sometimes directly, that don't worry, we're not going to do any ET, UFO type targets. And I was lying, of course, but I had to make sure that they believed it so that they would not know it was coming.
Gotcha.
And I also lied on the radio when I said, oh, no, we don't do things like that. We're not going to do it. And so they really bought it. And then in one project, I know I could get away with that only once. So in one project, I had three separate targets, one on the base on Mars, the Cydonia complex, and then on an anomaly on the surface of Iapetus, the moon of Saturn, and then the Phoenix Lights. And I put them all into one project so they wouldn't know about it till after all three were done. And so we did that, and that was sort of a huge dose there. But at that point, they didn't know what they were going to get. They were really sort of wondering, like, and other archaeological stuff. So I said, at this point, now is the time to hit them with the JFK. Now, Dick and Daz have worked with me on Farsight projects going way back to at least 2008. And very consistently, a huge public track record. We had lots of science projects, which we had public verification of the data collection process, all the bells and whistles. We had peer review publications. I mean, it was really a long track record. So their track record was as the best viewers in all of those projects. I mean, they were really stunning.
I'm aware of it as much as I can be on the outside here.
And so they were at the top of their game. And since we had already done the 9/11 project, the three UFO-type ET stuff, the Great Pyramid of Giza, we had done a whole bunch of stuff, I said, it's not going to get better than this. This is great. So I said, let's just slap them with this. They won't see it coming. And so now this was not so easy. You see, these viewers are so good. Daz Smith in Britain and Dick Allgaier in Hawaii, if I just gave them JFK, they would figure it out before I was done. Meaning, I had to have at least two targets for JFK. And if I gave them two targets, and those are the only two ones, they would have figured it out, and they would essentially, even though I told them no information, they were doing it blind, after they were halfway through, they would no longer be blind. They would figure out this could only be JFK. And so I had to mix it with another project. So just like with the UFO ET thing where I had, I called it the remote viewing of the aliens, I had Cydonia, Mars, I had the Phoenix Lights, and Anomaly on Iapetus. I mixed them all together. So they really were very confused on a conscious mind level. So the data were coming in really great. So with this one, I mixed it in with another target. So there were four targets.
Wow.
Two of them were JFK, and two of them we haven't announced yet. But I'm going to tell you the first, you will be the first peer person, and your audience will be the first person of what's coming out in January, which is the target that we mixed in with the JFK assassination stuff. So are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready when you are. Yeah.
And I mentioned this only not to preview what's coming, but to show you how thoroughly confused they got.
Uh-huh.
And that's what's supposed to happen. Because if you confuse the conscious mind, then the higher self can really get all types of stuff in.
Fascinating.
And so I threw in Adolf Hitler. So we had the assassination of JFK, and we have a new one. Now, the documentary that's coming out in January is Adolf Hitler, a remote viewing portrait, a remote viewing psychological portrait of a mass murderer. And we actually had the viewers go into the mind of Adolf Hitler while he was giving a famous speech in the Reichstag.
Huh.
And come out at a spot that would explain why he had all that vitriolic hatred at that very moment in time. To explain, to go back in time and find him, what caused him to have those feelings when he was the Führer.
Are we going to find out what...
And that's coming. Now you can imagine. Okay, now let's get back to JFK.
Yeah.
You can imagine them doing JFK with all the assassination and getting the stuff. I mean, amazingly clear. And suddenly, Hitler. Like, what the... They were saying, what's this? This is crazy stuff. I mean, this is like... It, like, made no sense to them. Until I got the targets afterwards. After the whole thing was done and they got all four targets, Daz wrote me an email and said, oh, so now it makes all sense.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my job. My job is to give them targets and to keep them thoroughly confused, but to let the data come flowing in until it's over, and then to give them what the target feedback is, and it fit like a glove. Boy, you won't. I have to tell you, Jeff, you will be just as surprised about Adolf Hitler as you are about the JFK stuff. So anyway, but that's how I fit JFK in. So
got it.
They kept it going. Now with the JFK thing, we had two targets. The first one was the actual assassination itself. So that's why Jim Mars is so important, because he's actually investigated a lot about the actual shooting itself.
Right.
The second one, however, was the highest level organizational meeting of those who planned the actual assassination.
Right.
So at first we get the people on the ground who did the shooting. And then
we've discussed with Dick, and then we discussed who done it with Dick.
Yeah, yeah. And that's how this all came about, this project.
That's wonderful. All right, let me bring on next the man who knows, again, more about the JFK murder than anyone. He is a friend, a colleague. He's a national treasure. In fact, he's a worldwide treasure. And we had to go literally off-planet, a man from Mars, to find out the truth about JFK. So here he is, the Martian himself, Gentleman James. Welcome aboard.
Thank you, Jeff. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, sir. How was your Christmas?
We had a white Christmas. There was snow on the ground yesterday.
Of course, you did get some.
It's all gone today, but...
well, good.
We had a little bit of a white Christmas.
Well, your home looked absolutely gorgeous, and thanks for sending the picture. It was nice. Very nice.
Yeah, we always just go nuts on Christmas.
Okay. You gotta go nuts. That's the day to do it.
Yep.
Let's now welcome Daz Smith. Daz is coming to us live where it's very early in the morning in Bath, England. He's not just a great remote viewer, he is also one of the historians of the remote viewing world. He publishes a great magazine called Eight Martinis, which is about remote viewing, not cocktails, he'll explain. He is working on a new book which will publish all of his raw, unedited data from his work on the 9/11 project that you heard Courtney talk about a couple minutes back. Daz is a staunch defender of our God-given birthright to publish and distribute all remote viewing data that any of us in this field come up with. I'm not a viewer, but this is a God-given right. You can't control someone else's gifts, their genetic background, and their gift of consciousness. His recent work on the Kennedy assassination is stunning, as you're going to hear tonight. So please don't go anywhere. Sit tight. It's going to be amazing. Look at images and guests at Rents. Load those up. Daz, welcome to the program. Dick Allgaier sends his regards to you. Speaks very highly of you, always has.
Thank you very much, and good morning from the UK. It's always an honor to be on your great radio show, Jeff, with such great peers and people that I respect.
Thank you, Daz. Thank you very much. Well, people like you make it such. You know, the interesting thing about what you and Dick do so astonishingly well is I like to think of it, in some cases, as you're literally time travelers. Literally. You're going back in time.
Yeah, absolutely. And with each project we do, we never try to lose that sense of wonderment, really, because, as you say, we are traveling anywhere in time and space, and it's at the stage that if you ever lose that awe at what you're doing... I think it's time to give up, but it's been 17, 18 years for me now, and every time I do a new experiment, it just blows me away. I always learn something new from each one as well.
Fascinating, fascinating. Now, Jim knows, Daz, say hello to Jim. I don't think you guys have met yet, have you?
No, we haven't. Hi, Jim. I've been a great fan of yours for a number of years as well, and I love your work. It's fantastic.
Well, howdy, Daz, and it's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm a big fan of your work, too. You and Dick just blow me away, and I'm not, as you well know, I'm not in small measure knowledgeable about remote viewing. I was kind of in on it pretty
early. He's got a book on it.
Absolutely, yeah. I know the book very well. I read it, I've read it more than a few times back to front, and it's one of those books that's one of the best in the remote viewing field, and it's an inspiration.
Well, thank you so much.
Now, we've done these programs before, and you've heard them, Daz, and you know the format. And I think what we should do is we're not going to do a break at the bottom of the hour. We're going to just go right through that and pick up another 6 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it is. And Courtney, you want to set this up briefly, then we'll have Daz go ahead and just wade into it, and then Jim will be here to comment, amplify. And this is so fascinating because Jim's work was absolutely validated by Dick Allgaier's remote viewing. I mean, it was stunning. That I'll never forget that program. And I'm sure the same kind of thing is in store for us tonight. You guys are just amazing with your God-given gifts. So, Courtney, go ahead and set this up real quick, if you would.
Sure, sure. First of all, let me say that a project like this really is orphaned without someone like Jim Mars. Because when you're doing something that's so extraordinary and so off the beaten path in terms of the mainstream story that's been told, if you just tell the story and get the information with remote viewing, and there's no background work, there's no historical work, there's no detective work, there's no forensic work, there's no one who's done the grunt work of getting all the data and putting all the facts together and saying, this is based on what we see in the field. If you don't have that, then the remote viewing is orphaned. So this is a really perfect combination to have someone like Jim Mars and someone like Daz Smith and Dick Allgaier talking at the same time about the same thing combined, because it's that synergy that makes the remote viewing produce that extra element, that new eyewitness account, and it makes it sense. And so we also get a good corroboration of all that.
Oh, the validation was staggering.
The validation. And without Jim Mars doing all that, we're sort of left saying, well, this is what we see, but then people are going to say, well, where's the evidence? So Jim Mars fills that huge gap. And it really produces that great synergy. Anyway, so just really quick, just to get things going, because you've had a great couple interviews with Dick Allgaier on this and Jim Mars, and now is your chance to really have Daz talk about it.
Yeah.
This is an extraordinary thing, because we had two targets. The first target dealt with the actual shooters. Now, I have to say a little bit about myself, just really briefly, and it's a criticism, actually. You see, I'm an academic. I don't do any remote viewing research at my university, but I am an academic. And academics like me, I have found to be, sometimes we're just not so smart. You see, what happens is we get data sets from official sources. We take a lot of things at point blank, at face value, mm-hmm. and we just start analyzing the data. We analyze the numerical data. I teach statistics and numerical analysis and so on. Yeah. And we just sort of say, okay, so that's what happened. Now let's analyze the data. We don't really fundamentally question the basics. And with the JFK thing, this is the thing I was going to have to confess. I was sort of taking the party line. I mean, the bottom, I was sort of going along with the orthodox view and saying, well, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald probably shot him. I knew there was some controversy, but...
that's where you were. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was so... And it's embarrassing to say it now.
It's okay.
But it's
honest.
But it is. I sort of saying, well, let's just actually scope it all out and find out exactly how it happened. I hadn't even studied the Zapruder film. I had seen it briefly. I knew of Jim Mars's work, but I hadn't gone into it in depth. And I sort of said, well, you know, it's probably... And I actually said the words in my own mind, it's probably all conspiracy stuff. But on the other hand, I am the leading scholar in the subject of remote viewing, as it's done using these military or military-derived methodologies. Mm-hmm. I know the quality of these viewers. I know the data can be, as extraordinarily accurate as it is. And I knew the experimental design was set up clean because I set it up. So when I had these data come in, they weren't verifying and validating what I already believed. They were pushing me off a cliff. And I said, what? I said, uh-huh. Look at this. Mm-hmm. And then the data. And the thing about working with people like Daz Smith and Dick Allgaier is they're so blankety blank good. They get the same stuff. I mean, it's like,
that's
what's
almost
the probability?
Scary. Yeah, that's
impossible for just random choice. And target after target, project after project, it's like getting photocopies. But they, in addition to like the 80% of the stuff that's like a duplicate, they add their own individual additions. They sort of complement, but extend out in different ways. But they both got the idea of, and I'm not talking vague ambiguous, foggy, fuzzy stuff. I'm talking really clear, explicit descriptions, verbal descriptions, all recorded live on video, raw video, and then really great drawings and sketches, like a schematic. I mean, a police detective couldn't ask for anything better. The whole story was stuck out. And it validated all of Jim Mars's stuff. And it sent me off the edge of the Grand Canyon, and I said, hey, I'm an idiot. I admit, I'm an idiot. I'm an academic. Academics are idiots sometimes. What can I say?
You learn, though. You learn. You're open.
But I learned this lesson too often.
Nah.
But at least I'm willing to look at the data and say, whoa. You know, the thing is, we don't even teach this at the university. Any university. I'm talking any university in the whole world, I guess, but certainly not in this country. It's still taught in the universities and the high school levels as Lee Harvey Oswald, a soul shooter. They don't even question that this is. And so then, anyway, so Dick and Daz, on a probabilistic basis, it's so minuscule you can't even find the last. You can't even count the number of digits before you get your first significant digit in the probability scale. They came in with exactly the same thing: two teams of shooters. Plus peripheral support people. And the teams, Daz was really very clear on the makeup and the minute-by-minute description of what each member of the teams were doing. They had two teams of three people each. Now, I want you to ask Daz about this, but there were two teams of three people each, one shooter, one helper, and one sort of overseer. Each one had three. Daz actually followed each member of each team's through the shooting, and then as they walked off.
Wow!
Now Dick got the same thing: two teams of shooters, and they both did the same numbers. Everything was like amazing, but there was no element, in my view, in this at all that looked like Lee Harvey Oswald as a shooter. So it all looked like. These were really expert marksmen and really expert. So anyway, that's what Daz came in. So if you're looking at the shooter stuff and you're looking at Daz's stuff, and since he's here, he should really be the one to talk about it. And then if Jim Mars could sort of jump that's the amazing thing. When Daz gets to that part in the first documentary on the shooters, that's when your jaw literally hits the floor.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're looking forward for that. The last thing I want to tell folks is when you task them with a target, they receive an envelope, right? How do they get the numbers and letters for the target?
In the old days, we used to, and I'm talking like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Actually, before that, we used to send out target coordinates, which is two sets of four-digit random numbers. And we don't do that. We haven't done that for well over 10 years. All I did is send them an email each, in the same email, saying, hi, guys, we're ready to start the next project. It's project number 10. Send me a session. Get your stuff. Send it in as soon as you get ready. And that was it. So the only thing they heard was, this is the new project, project number 10, and send me sessions. They didn't even get target coordinates. They have to actually make up their own target coordinates. All I know is there's a project, and they're told to send in sessions. End of story.
Boy, it doesn't get any cleaner than that.
Else.
Wow.
In another interview or something, there's a reason why this works. We're not ignorant of the physics of how this works.
Very good. All right.
But that's the answer to what they're given. They're given other than, we're going to start a new project, guys. Go.
Okay. Well, we'll do that another time, Courtney, because it's a critical part of the whole protocol. All right. James, anything you want to add before we jump into this?
No, I'm ready to hear what they got.
Yeah. Jim has a little sniffle from some stuff there, but you sound fine. Just want you to know that. And we're off and running. All right. Mr. Daz Smith, take it away. Let's go.
Okay. What bit would you like to hear about first? The shooters or the actual people that arranged this?
What would you like to know? The whodunit or the shooters? What do you want to hear first?
We'll start with the shooters.
All right. Let's go with the two teams
and work backwards.
Okay. Very good. Two teams of three shooters. All right. or three Excellent. People.
Yep, yep. I mean, in my RV data, I clearly had data of what ended up being, because at the time we do it, we don't know what it is, ended up being the two teams of shooters. And this clearly came across my data because I saw all this information about a passenger in a moving vehicle, and the moving vehicle was stopped by an abrupt energy. And in my drawings and sketches, I managed to describe two forms of energy that came from two different directions. But what conflicts with the official story of Oswald shooting from behind was I never picked any of that up at all in any of my RV. I had two sets of shooters, one from the front, and that was on the left, and they were higher. They were up higher than the person they were shooting. And it felt like the other set of shooters were from the front again, but from the right. And it felt like they were lower than the person that was traveling in the vehicle. But I never picked up anything at all from what we would feel to be a shot from the scorebook depository.
That's an interesting point. Let me ask you to hold that. Jim Morris, the shooters on the right, Daz had a sense that they might be physically slightly lower at one point than the target. Would the grassy knoll, in your research, lend itself to that kind of a configuration?
Well, wait a minute before we get too confused. Daz, when you say to the left, are you saying to the left looking towards the car or from the left if you were in the car?
I would say left in front of the car, looking up at the car. So that I would say that would be the grassy knoll area, which was higher.
Right.
And
right.
The other area would
okay,
be lower.
So from JFK's perspective, the shooters on the right are the grassy knoll, and the shooters on the left are the second team. Which one would be lower at one point, do you feel? The left or the right, from JFK's perspective?
Well, any shooters on the grassy knoll would have been at the top of the knoll behind the fence, which would have placed them significantly higher than the road, because Elm Street at that point dips down. It goes into Dealey Plaza. It's kind of been a bowl. Actually, it's a triangular-shaped park, and it slopes downward to the triple underpass. Now, when he says there's a team of shooters shooting low, that's really fascinating, because there is a very little known and largely ignored and laughed off aspect of the assassination, which is that there are some people who say that a shot came from a storm drain. And I actually, years ago, climbed down into this storm drain, and it's got a big slit there at road level, you know, kind of like a bunker. And I'm short, but I could stand in there. And from that point, shooting towards the center lane of the road would have been about 6 feet, which is, you know, that's a pistol shot. And I'm not going to go into it, but I have other evidence and other witnesses who add to the idea that there may have been a shot from this storm drain, which when Penn Jones first brought that up back in the 60s, everybody laughed at him and said, he said there's a shot from the sewer. And they keep talking about the sewer and to put, you know, to make it sound ludicrous. But it actually is a very real possibility.
Okay, now that's the rain gutter. And I've looked at that, and it's, well, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet of open curb where the rainwater goes into the sewer.
Uh-huh.
And you took the lid off and climbed down in there.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And you had a view.
Way,
there
was like a pretty large pipe that I think a small person could crawl through that went all the way to the top of the grassy knoll and came out behind that.
Oh,
fence.
My.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, it gets stranger, because some years ago I was contacted by a fellow who had worked for the Dallas Street Department, and he said that there had been a collapse right there of the ground, right along the east side of the Triple Underpass, right exactly about where this water pipe was. And he said that apparently somebody in the not too distant past, or in the distant past of them, keep in mind this information came in maybe in the early 90s, I guess, and he said somebody had gone in there and had dug down to where this pipe was, and then cut the top of the pipe open in about a 2-foot section, 2 foot by, say, maybe 1.5 foot, and then had put it back down but had not welded it. And so over a period of years, as the ground softened and as rains came and everything, this thing gave way, and the ground collapsed along through there, and they had to go in there and repair it. Well, he called me because he said, it sounds like somebody went in that pipe to retrieve something, but it was not anything that was done by the city because there was no record of it. And he said, because that's in Dealey Plaza where the assassination took place, he thought I might be interested.
Wow, how fortuitous that he called you. Amazing. Yeah.
So there you have again some tantalizing evidence.
Yeah.
Not, you know, it's nothing hard and 100% proof, but that what the suspicion is that somebody either dumped a weapon from the top down that pipe or from the storm drain up into that pipe, and then later decided they better come get it and retrieve it. And then they didn't do it. They kind of botched the job because although they cut into the pipe, they didn't weld it shut again, and it collapsed and revealed what had happened.
Well, there's a fascinating piece of history. Jeff, go ahead, Daz.
Jeff, this is Courtney. I might make a comment here about the remote viewing stuff. Mm-hmm. As someone who's been analyzing these types of data for a long time, I have found that there's certain types of conclusions you can sort of bet the bank on. And then there's other types of information that may be correct and probably is correct. But the actual level of accuracy of the details may or may not be exact. So one of the things that I've really noticed that is, if I look at these data and I say, what is the piece that I would bet the bank on? Well, the pieces that I would bet the bank on is both Daz and Dick came in with exactly the same information on this aspect, that there were two teams of shooters and that they were in different locations, meaning they were not in the same spot. Now, you're debating now the issue of whether it might have come from the left or the right or a little higher, a little lower. That's okay. That's actually interesting. And that's part of the data that you sort of want to look at with remote viewing data. Like, they could give you an indication of maybe where that might have happened. But the stuff that you want to bet the bank on and say, this is going to be true, you're not going to have to worry about this, is the fact that there were two teams of shooters and they were not located in the same spot, meaning the shots came from different directions.
Gotcha.
So that's really crucial. Now, this is where Jim Mars' stuff comes really in. Once you've sort of accepted two teams of shooters, different locations, each team having three people, then you turn to Jim Mars and say, okay, where could they have been? We know now there were two teams and the shots came from different directions. And then where all this other stuff. So this is how you sort of blend remote viewing data with the forensic stuff that Jim Mars does. The remote viewing sort of helps you establish the basic facts on the ground, and then the detailed forensic stuff that Jim Mars does fills in a lot of these gaps.
Okay. All right. Let's get back to Daz. Okay, Daz, excuse me. The possibility that someone was in that storm drain at curb height, maybe a solo shooter, don't know. Interesting. It's been talked about in the periphery for a long, long time. But your two teams seem to be up on the grassy knoll and on the other side of the triple underpass. Am I correct?
Yes, yes. And clearly in the sketches I do on the whiteboard for Courtney as well, live on camera, you can see that there was it was almost like a perfect placement where the shots would intersect.
Right.
At a point, and that point, you know, in my data, as I said, we didn't notice at the time of doing it, happened to be where someone was in a vehicle, and I clearly state right from the very beginning on this remote viewing that the entire target is based around a passenger. And this passenger was not only a passenger in a vehicle, but he was a passenger within an event that he had no way to control.
He was a victim of fate, as it were.
Absolutely. That came across right in the very first session of doing this. Hmm. And in the sketches, yeah, you can clearly see a V-shaped intersection of energy and motion. Because in remote viewing, I'm not allowed to say as part of the process bullets were moving. So I have to say things. I have to use descriptive terms. So I use the terms of man-made solid objects.
Mm-hmm.
And I clearly note that there were two propelled, fast-moving, man-made solid objects that intersected with the vehicle, stopping the vehicle and the life form. And then at that stage, it gets very weird in session because I clearly note that someone dies and goes through a dying process. And I also follow that person through the entire dying process to what happens to them.
Daz, excuse me. Were you able to feel inside that person, to view, to experience, in some experiential fashion, sense? Did he die immediately, or was there a time when he... That's a grievous wound
actually,
he suffered.
Actually, before Des answers that, can I insert just something small?
Go ahead.
When all of Des's stuff was sent in, and I put it together with Dick's, we had a documentary, a remote viewing documentary that went on for 2 hours and 20 minutes. Actually, it was longer. It was like almost 3 hours. So I said, I have to cut something to get it down to 2 hours and 20 minutes because we just can't fit any more than that on a DVD. The piece I cut out, which we're going to release later, was at least 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes of Daz describing JFK after the death, meaning when JFK left the body. So let Daz tell you, but the point is it's not in the documentary, but it's going to come out. It's the after-death experience of JFK. It's fascinating stuff, and Daz got all of it.
All right. Well, I didn't mean to step into another area, but that's a crucial one. And the documentary, the DVD, Courtney, tell them where to get it real quick.
Well, it's farsight.org, www.farsight, like seeing far, F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T. And it's right there at the top, a huge banner, and it can get it with, there are links on our website that go to Vimeo for instantly seeing it, as well as a DVD on Amazon. But let Daz talk a little bit about what you just asked about, which was the
very good
the death experience itself, because it really is fascinating.
Okay. I want to also thank our sponsors who are giving up their time so this program, an historically very important program, can continue uninterrupted. Go ahead, Daz. Tell us about the death process. What did you feel?
Clearly, during this event, and bear in mind it was blind, and in the 18 years I've been doing this, this is the first time I've actually had a proper death event target given to me. So it was a bit of a shock to myself, but I felt that someone was going through a death process that they met. It was sudden as well. It was planned, but they didn't know it was planned. It was a sudden event that they were involved in, and I managed to move into the body or mind of the person, which we now know as JFK, and I could feel and sense all of his emotions and his thoughts as he was dying through the process, which wasn't instantaneous. It was, I think it was probably a minute or two over the process, really. And I managed to see his state of mind in a panicked, excited state, thinking about family, thinking about things he was leaving behind, all the normal things a normal person would think about. And then I followed that thought pattern through a few more minutes, and then it went through a stage of calmness, then almost come out another side into a different realm, which felt completely different in physical appearance. And there I felt that he actually, and bearing in mind, this is the first time I've done this, I actually felt that he did meet with other life forms that material. It was strange because they were what I call distributed, these life forms. They were almost like a gas that only came together into a form at the moment when they wanted to communicate, or where you wanted to communicate to them.
Or when he needed them.
Yes, yes.
How fascinating. This goes into the realm of NDE, or I call it in many cases ADE, after-death experience. which I had last April. And it's an extraordinary field, to put it mildly. Jim, step in here. What do you got?
Well, it's, what happens after death is a little bit outside of my normal.
It's tough to spend 52 years and not think about it, but this is a remarkable thing we're hearing.
Although I will say this, one conclusion I've come to, and I don't know if Courtney and Daz would agree with this, but it seems to me that the entire universe, everything that we know, physical and non-physical, is energy. And as science tells us, energy can neither be created nor destroyed, can only change form. And so I think that obviously when the thing that animates most human beings is the electromagnetic energy field that energizes their body and probably houses certainly the brain power and probably what would be called the soul. And so I think that's in a way is kind of encouraging, because I think this means that when we die, the physical body obviously turns to dust. But I think the energy that is actually us, it continues on somewhere.
Daz?
Absolutely. I totally agree on that. And the thing is, I've been studying this kind of subject and, you know, life and death and all that kind of stuff for years now, and I didn't really have a convincing thought in my head about it. You know, I hoped that there was something out there, but I never actually experienced it. And I never experienced it from, you know, kind of another person's point of view. So I'm a bit of a duality when I'm doing the remote viewing, because I'm me, but I'm also feeding mm-hmm. the thoughts mm-hmm. of someone else at the same time. So it's a bit of a schizophrenic type of feeling when you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So to actually feel someone go through a process of being really fearful, you know, because this happened fast to him, I could really feel the intense fear and surprise. Then to feel a little bit of pain, and then to almost feel the person you're letting go of their kind of like worldly thoughts, their thoughts of their family and stuff, and then moving through this really nice calmness to a complete different state of being. It was totally shocking to me. Even more so, obviously, you know, finding that it was the person we all respect is JFK.
The most important little footnote I would add here is the obvious, and that's that JFK didn't die in the traditional sense instantaneously. From what we just heard, it took a minute or so, and he did have thoughts, and his mind was still processing and working on the physical realm here as he began to transition. This is really amazing.
With his final thoughts that you were privy to, obviously, as most people, I think, they would think about their family and their loved ones, but was there any thoughts at all about, wait a minute, what happened here, and who did it?
There were a few fleeting thoughts like that as well, yeah. But it was a really strange process, because it was like I could feel those thoughts. I could feel a little bit of anger. I could feel, you know, I could feel the physical fear. But it really did not take long at all for them to almost fade. It's a very hard process, and it's probably easier to see it when I'm going for it on camera, because, you know, I'm really in there then, and I get quite emotional at the time as well. But yeah, it's almost like they just dissipate, and it's very strange, and they dissipate quite fast. It's almost like whatever is left of you as a person really does adapt quite fast to the situation what's happening to you.
I can testify to that. It is very fast, and the place you go is so calm and so peaceful and so happy and so free of anger, angst, all the emotions we deal with all the time. And there's the white light issue. What you're saying makes total sense to me. But there was, because this man was a visionary in many ways. He was driven. He knew he had a lot of work to do, and this was taken from him. And he knew that, and that would create anger. He was angry. He could not finish what he was about. Amazing.
Actually, Jeff, Daz's session is interesting because of the really rapid readjustment that JFK had after the death experience, meaning mm-hmm. There was a surprise. Daz reported a surprise, really sort of a shock surprise, but JFK really did adapt very quickly, and he was okay with it. He was at peace. He didn't lash out like, how dare those damn blankety blank blank blank. It was a really rapid adjustment, given what he did. The vibration of that guy was not a vibration of anger and hostility. The vibration of that guy was a very enlightened, altruistic visionary, and that stayed with him even after his death experience.
Right, right. Daz did say it was a fleeting bit of anger, and it went away. This is all remarkable. Daz, please continue.
That whole experience, as I said, I've never encountered before. It's almost a project on its own, really, like life after death thing. And I think Courtney was quite shocked at seeing this appear on its own in the middle of an assassination project. As I said, he died with anger, surprise, a lot of fear. It moves on. He goes into a state of beautiful calmness, and then there's this, it is literally like an awakening. He emerges out the other end, feeling a lot more spiritual, a lot more calm. He's let everything go, all the anger and fear, all the thoughts of his family kind of dissipate pretty fast as well. I did see these other life forms I can only describe as his past family and friends that are there, but they're not there as physical form. They only become physical shapes when one person thinks about them or they want to interact, and then it's like mist that coalesces into a form for a few seconds as it interacts, and then it kind of transforms back into mist again until it needs to communicate again. And this happens from three or four different directions. As life forms move forward to maybe shake hands or congratulate someone or something, they form out of a mist and then dissipate again. So it was a very strange thing to see.
Wow. Okay. Makes sense to me. I got to the point where I had let everything go, and then 4.5 hours later, my eyes popped open in intensive care just before they were going to operate on my brain, and I stopped them. It seems I got sent back. Whatever. And I'm glad to be here. But this is what you're describing is, to me, not at all different than what I went through. And I didn't go as far, obviously. I wouldn't be here. But this is... Now, folks, you can get the DVD and watch Daz and Dick on the whiteboard with marking pencils, talking as they're in session doing this. It's really unprecedented, and it's something you really should look at.
You know, this is amazing. I might add, Jeff, that in the old days, people did remote viewing with paper and pen.
Yes, yes,
While we still do that, we just do it now as warm-up sessions to get ready to go on video. But we found that people didn't like watching people draw on paper and pen. So what the standing up and doing it on with a dry erase board allows us to do is to have the viewers do it live, standing up, looking at the camera, interacting with the audience, totally blind. And it's a game changer for us to be able to do that. And Dick and Daz are absolutely at the top of their field in being able to do that. And, you know, a lot of other people are trying to do that, to gain that level of professionalism. But they really are at the very top of the game in terms of it being able to do that. And I might also add that when they do that and they're interacting, there are some moments that give you a chill. There's another way to describe it. When they're just describing something, and then, like Daz does this quite often, he'll describe something and then there'll be a pause and he'll make a chuckling noise, like, that's odd. Like, you can tell he's right there watching it and he's saying, And now this person's doing that. And then he carefully describes exactly what that person does. One of the things that he really describes in this, which with a level of clarity that I've never seen before, is literally the minute-by-minute description of what the three guys in each team were doing. And this really sort of fits in with the crossfire stuff that Jim Mars has done. And that is that the is that bumper music? Or?
No, I don't know what it's a hum.
Okay.
Keep talking.
That basically is that these guys, both shooters, and they both had helpers and an overseer. So there's three people in each team. Those guys were expert marksmen. They were not people who just, you know, picked up a gun. This official story with Lee Harvey Oswald, I have since this documentary become an expert on all of the stuff that Jim Mars has reported and all of the so-called conspiracy. I now know that whole background. That gun that the government people say that Lee Harvey Oswald used was broken. It was gunky. The telescopic sight on it could not be, it was broken. And the government's own witnesses, their own gun experts, when they took the gun and tried to examine it, they said they tried to fix the telescopic sight with shims, and they couldn't fix it. It was so badly broken. That gun could not be shot accurately over a distance. In addition, Daz and Dick clearly described that the people who did the shooting were expert marksmen. Now, I don't know a lot about guns, but I do know a lot about race car drivers and people who shoot guns as expert marksmen. And that is, they take care of their equipment. It's like Paul Newman, the race car driver.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
They take care of their equipment. The race car driver, actor Paul Newman, he took care of his race cars like they were, you know, like he was married to them. And the point is that whoever shot JFK, they were expert marksmen without any question. They shot from a very considerable distance. They hit it spot on. There were no missing guns, no missing shots. And those people don't shoot broken guns. And the gun that the government says was used to shoot JFK,
right,
that was a busted gun, and there's no way an expert marksman would have shot that thing.
No, it's a canard.
Courtney, let me point
out. Yeah, I'm going to get to. Go ahead, Jim. Then we got to take a break. Go ahead.
Quickly, the Warren Commission was very considerate because they actually published the photographs of the three metal shims that they said they had to place under the telescopic sight to make it try to bring it into alignment, just so they could make it accurate enough to test.
Wow.
That's how bad it was.
And that is real bad.
If you look at the actual Zapruder film, you can clearly see whoever shot him from a distance and was an expert marksman.
Yeah.
Those were not like wild shots that went off.
No, this was highly
precise. And when you look at
precise.
Daz's data and Dick's data, mm-hmm. they clearly describe expert sharpshooter marksmen that had military or paramilitary backgrounds that knew what they were doing. And Daz, if you have time, he can actually tell you, it's actually in the documentary.
All right.
How they open the case up, take the gun out.
Okay. We're going to do that right after the break. We'll come back some most of the next hour and let's follow Daz and his narrative through this. Can't wait to hear what Jim has to say about this. So we'll do that as we continue in just a few minutes. Hang on. Don't go away.